Marketplace is supported by Nuance Power PDF, designed for easy implementation to accurately convert, combine, and collaborate on business documents. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The monetary policy phrase of the day is considerable time, as in how long the Fed is going to keep interest rates low. Asked how long that might be at a press conference today, Janet Yellen basically said, "I am not going to tell you." From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Kronos, offering cloud-based workforce management solutions to help organizations of all types and sizes achieve their strategic goals. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device. More at GoToMeeting.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday. This one is the 17th of September. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. 4 minutes and 38 seconds. 4 minutes and 38 seconds to tell us she is not going to tell us how long a considerable time is. How long, in other words, until interest rates go up. That is right at the top of the list of economic unknowns right now. So question one for Fed Chair Janet Yellen today was, how long? I'll spare you the whole thing, but the bottom line was, we'll know it when we see it.
I know considerable time sounds like it's a calendar concept, but it is highly conditional, and it's linked to the committee's assessment of the economy.
Yeah, so that. Elsewhere in macroeconomics, inflation numbers were out today that might complicate the Fed's calculations. Dr. Yellen et al. Want inflation somewhere near 2%. But this morning, we learned consumer prices actually fell last month. Not, I'm sure, what the Fed has had in mind. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
When the Labor Department released the Consumer Price Index numbers for August today, Janet Yellen got a shock. Everybody expected the CPI to come in just shy of the Fed's goal of 2% inflation, but the actual number, 1.7%. Inflation is just not being cooperative.
CPI is a little bit like the puppy that refuses to get housebroken and is spoiling the Fed's carpet.
That's Jonathan Lewis, who, yes, is in the midst of training a stubborn puppy, but is also chief investment officer at Samson Capital Advisors. He says today's inflation numbers are a mess for the Fed, a warning flag. Mark Gertler is an economist at NYU. He's also disappointed with the CPI numbers.
The low inflation numbers are a symptom of weakness in the economy. The economy is still not as strong as we would like.
That's a problem for the Fed because it can't raise interest rates when the economy is weak, and the Fed can't keep rates near zero forever. But Gennady Goldberg sees a bright side for the Fed. He's U.S. strategist for TD Securities.
The lower inflation is actually giving them quite a bit of breathing room. There's very little pressure on the Fed to hike interest rates now.
And everybody expects inflation to get up to where the Fed wants it eventually. As asset manager and dog lover Jonathan Lewis puts it, puppies will get trained sooner or later. It just takes some longer than others. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As I was walking into the studio just now, this item flashed on the Reuters wire. The Carolina Panthers have placed defensive end Greg Hardy on the exempt list over a domestic violence case, which means basically he is banned from team activities until the case is cleared up. What's happening with the National Football League right now is a curious combination of public and economic pressure. Stan Alcorn has that story.
If you're disappointed in the NFL, you've got company. Corporate company. McDonald's, Visa, Campbell's Soup, and now Anheuser-Busch, owner of its official beer, Bud Light, says it is, quote, disappointed and increasingly concerned. The beverage company has a $1.2 billion contract with the league, and sports law professor Gabe Feldman says that money talks.
The NFL here is a multi-billion dollar business. If some of those billions start to get threatened, I think the NFL is going to stand up and take notice.
But so far, sponsors have stopped short of threatening to tear up their contracts with the league, though Radisson Hotels has cut ties with the Minnesota Vikings.
There are a lot of sports properties, but there's only one NFL.
That's Kenneth Shropshire at Wharton. He says the size and engagement of the NFL's audience insulates it from criticism more than, say, the NBA.
The next closest sports are, you know, $3-4 billion behind. So it's astronomically larger, even though we don't think of it as such.
He thinks advertisers are more likely to apply pressure behind the scenes than unravel expensive relationships with America's most popular sport. But that doesn't mean there aren't looming financial implications for the NFL, according to media and marketing expert Ken Atherton.
You know, I think if you were a sponsor right now contemplating an investment in the NFL, you'd probably wait.
And if more damning details come out, Atherton says the big money advertisers could do more than just talk. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
After a little bit of a hiccup, traders decided they liked what Janet Yellen was saying today. After all, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been spending a part of each day this week talking about the future of television, how we're watching it, how networks think we're watching it, and for today's installment of our series, Screen Wars, how all that watching is going to be paid for.
Television.
Got this.
No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
We've heard so far that the people who make the television you watch are feeling pretty good about how things are going out there. And you can hear those interviews, by the way, on our website. It's marketplace.org. But what about the people who are trying to sell you stuff while you're watching TV? I mean, I hate to break it to you, but your attention span is not getting any longer, you know. So how are broadcasters going to keep convincing advertisers to keep paying for commercials that you keep looking away from? Amanda Richman is president at Starcom. That is an advertising agency. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Maybe we ought to start for the lay people among us who don't understand your world. How do you do your job? What is your job?
My job is to oversee investment in media across a wide portfolio of clients and particularly help them navigate the tremendous change that's happening in the marketplace today, understanding that it's no longer the world of connecting with their consumers via television spots and radio and publishing, but it's gotten much more expansive with digital and the ability to connect with them with mobile, social, all powered by data.
Yeah, so we'll get to mobile in a second, but talk to me more about data. What little nuggets do you value the most?
What's interesting about data is that in this world, and the headline is often big data.
Big data, right.
It's less about having a volume of data and more about understanding what data matters, understanding their behaviors around viewing, whether that's second screen viewing with tablet and television at the same time, whether it's understanding what's the role of the product in their lives, and particularly what's their purchase behavior, all becomes fodder for fueling a richer profile that helps us understand where to connect more powerfully.
This is completely hypothetical and quite possibly totally random, but let's just spitball this here and see how granular we can get. Is it possible that someday in the near-ish future, I will be sitting on my couch in my living room in suburbia watching Scandal, and I will see ad X, and a 22-year-old woman sitting on the other side of LA on her couch watching Scandal will at the same instant in time see ad Y?
That scenario we are probably 2 to 4 years away.
No, only 2 to 4 years. Are you kidding me?
Yes, I'm bold predictions.
Wow, that's nuts.
But we are looking at a world of dynamic ad insertion.
Wow.
And what that offers the opportunity to do is understand that in your neighborhood and knowing your general age and demos, probably from data of your cable subscription or perhaps Netflix subscription, that you're going to be more likely to look for perhaps a car ad because you're in the market for that versus another audience member who may be looking at cosmetics or pet food or whatever things that we can use to distinguish who's in that household sitting on that couch.
There is, it seems to me, a dual screen, a two screen conundrum, right? If I'm sitting on my living room couch watching, I don't know, Scandal maybe, and an ad comes on, and at that point I kind of tune out mentally and pick up my tablet and, you know, look up whatever it is, you know, check my Twitter feed, whatever, the advertiser on television then loses in the two screen scenario.
Not necessarily.
Oh.
So if the television network, the advertiser can understand reading the signal, and there is a technology that allows you to read the signal of what the audio is on television in the room
man.
And what spot is running and sync that with the ability through promoted tweets or through other experiences. There's actually ways in second screen to enhance the advertising versus be a distraction or take the attention away from the spot that's airing.
I wonder if you guys just sit around the office and say, you know what, the sky's the limit. Let's think of the craziest technological thing we can think of, the most amazingly granular advertisement. Hey, let's see if it could work, right?
You know what? In this time and era, I tell you, it's the best time to be in the media business because there is a lot of opportunity for blue sky thanks to technology, thanks to the abundance of data, and the great creativity that's happening in this space.
Amanda Richman, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Guy. Really enjoyed the conversation.
You can check out the rest of our series, Screen Wars, at our website. It's marketplace.org. And if you happen to be more of a mobile phone kind of screen person, we've got apps, too. They're at the App Store and at Google Play. The biggest, most amazing, most spectacular, and incredible initial public offering in the history of public offerings is going to happen Friday. All right, maybe I'm overselling that just a little bit, but the huge and profitable Chinese e-commerce site Alibaba will start trading in New York. Shares will be priced at $66 to $68 a whack to start, which means total proceeds could top $25 billion, one big chunk of which will go to one specific American company. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looks now at how much cash Yahoo might get and what it might do with the money.
After taxes, Yahoo will probably raise around $6 billion and change. The company has indicated roughly half of that will go back to the shareholders in the form of dividends, says equity analyst Scott Kessler at S&P Capital IQ. But given that Yahoo has had virtually no growth in years, Kessler thinks the company should use some of its windfall to make a bigger splash.
To significantly move the needle in terms of how people think about Yahoo and how it's positioned, you know, we think kind of a bigger, bolder strategy makes sense.
Kessler suggests Yahoo try to make flashy billion-dollar-plus acquisitions in the mobile market, which is growing fast. Analyst Carl Howe at 451 Research says buying more Chinese internet companies wouldn't be a bad bet. And Yahoo could also spend more to compete for eyeballs and online ads with rivals Google and Facebook.
You buy into some sort of big content deal with another source of traffic, for example, a Netflix, an HBO, boosting business by just driving more traffic.
One thing Howe doesn't expect Yahoo to spend money on, a name change, as in losing that exclamation point at the end of Yahoo.
That would probably be the best thing they could do. The exclamation point showed it had the karma in 1996. It's a little old at this point.
Howe says changing internet graphics and branding wouldn't cost billions, but at this point it would just be a distraction, so don't hold your breath. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The electric utility that serves Duluth, Minnesota and its environs is mothballing four of its coal power generating plants, and not because the Environmental Protection Agency told it to either. Minnesota Power is shutting them down for 3 months because it can't get its hands on enough coal. Railroads and rail cars are crazy busy carrying oil from North Dakota, for one thing, and that is causing all kinds of other delays. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Al Rudick is Vice President of Strategy and Planning for Minnesota Power. The Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad has delivered the utility's coal for decades. And I asked him, has this kind of thing happened before?
This is unprecedented. We've never had to shut our units off because we can't get the coal we need. This year, they've had a lot of challenges on their rail system in terms of congestion, weather, and a lot of business.
And a lot of unhappy customers. Farmers can't get a bumper crop to market. Automakers say they generally have more than 100,000 vehicles on a given day just sitting, waiting to get picked up by a train. Professor Alan Zaremski runs the Railroad Engineering Program at the University of Delaware.
On some of the high-demand routes, we're reaching capacity, and so railroads have to now start increasing capacity. The downside of that is increasing capacity is not something you do in a couple of hours.
If you've got a right-of-way, he says it's a year or three. Meanwhile, it's not like those customers have other options. No other railroad even serves Minnesota Power. which is why it's such a great time to be in the railroad business. Profits are way up. Eric Marshall is a portfolio manager for Hodges Mutual Funds, which has been investing in railroads for more than 10 years.
You and I couldn't go out and start a railroad today, regardless of how much money we had, because we couldn't get all the easements and everything to go out and build a railroad across the country.
So for now, Minnesota Power is stockpiling coal, hoping to build up a supply to get itself through the winter. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman from Marketplace.
Coming up, why do studios make bad movies?
So now they're dealing with reporting to people who don't necessarily care about movies that much, and they're also reporting to shareholders.
Thoughts from a film critic, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, on this Fed day, the Dow Industrials rose 24 points, less than 0.2%, closed at 17,156. The NASDAQ advanced 9 points, 0.2%, 45.62. The S&P 500 gained 2 points, 0.1%, ended things at 2,001. Home builders rallied after confidence in the market for new homes rose more than expected this month. Lennar chipped up 5.5%. D.R. Horton drove up 3%. Toll Brothers rang up 2% today. FedEx rose 3%. Its quarterly profits increased, beating analyst forecasts as it delivered to more people shopping online. Bond prices were slightly higher. The yield fell to 2.6%. And you, yes, you, you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duff and Phelps, the global valuation and corporate finance advisor, balancing technical knowledge and market insight to help clients make sound decisions. DuffandPhelps.com. And by MailChimp. More than 6 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com. Marketplace's coverage of wealth and poverty issues is supported by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. More at FordFoundation.org. Have something to say about one of our stories or want to suggest your own? Find us on Twitter at Marketplace or join us on Facebook to interact with producers, reporters, and the hosts of Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology holds a hearing on the science of dyslexia. The Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for August. And tomorrow, you have an excuse. It's National Cheeseburger Day. Not that you need my permission to eat a cheeseburger, but you have it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Each side in the Scottish independence vote that comes tomorrow has its talking points, its spin, economic benefits or costs, the political upside or downside. Fairly standard politicking, right? Except with national identity quite literally on the line, there's a lot more emotion in this vote than usual. From Glasgow, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
A string of major companies say they'll pull their headquarters out of Scotland if it votes for independence. Big supermarket chains say separation will push up prices. Deutsche Bank claims the country could be plunged into another Great Depression. Some eminent academics even question Scotland's sanity.
I think it's driven by a kind of collective madness. I think from the vantage point of an economic historian, this is obviously going to be a disastrous move.
Niall Ferguson, expatriate Scotsman and professor of history at Harvard.
I live in the United States, but still feel myself every inch a Scotsman. But this is a bit like Colorado seeking its independence. This is just astonishing to behold.
Some critics say Scotland's in the grip of Braveheart fever, carried away by a fantasy of liberation, just like Mel Gibson in the movie.
But they'll never take our freedom!
But the calm, softly spoken, supremely rational professor of economics and supporter of independence, Mike Danson, says that's absolute nonsense.
Nobody talks about Braveheart in Scotland.
For very, very few people is that what independence is about. Some have said it will be the first case of a country trying to become independent on the back of economics rather than on the back of heart and emotion and identity.
More than 200 small and medium-sized Scottish businesses like this cheesecake maker in Ayr support independence. They say if the country separates, it'll be much more prosperous and fairer than it is today. The boss of this company, Frances Barron, says she'll definitely be voting yes and using her head.
I would say the majority of people will be voting from their head as well, because people are getting their eyes opened and their mouths are hanging open when they actually hear just how wealthy this country is and how well positioned that we are to move forward with independence.
The Yes campaign ads have bragged relentlessly about how rich Scotland is.
And an independent Scotland would be among the top 20 wealthiest countries in the world.
And they've promised a glittering array of extra social and welfare benefits.
Just imagine what we could do with our vast wealth and resources.
Including its geographic share of North Sea oil, Scotland is per capita richer than the rest of the UK, and it raises more tax. With its oil, whiskey and other products, it's a champion exporter. But the oil is declining and most of its other exports go to England. Severing national ties with their biggest market and closest neighbour has raised concern among many voters here.
I'm worried about what's going to happen. What's going to happen to my pension? What's going to happen to my healthcare?
It's a very worrying time. It's a huge decision, this. The biggest that we'll ever make.
It will be much more expensive to run a country of 5 million people. Everything will cost much more per head.
You're going to be voting no.
Absolutely. I am totally opposed to nationalism in any form. I think it just causes division and split, which is what it's doing now to Scottish society.
You're telling me to leave my country if they get a yes vote.
The referendum campaign has grown increasingly emotional on both sides, with angry exchanges in the street. But David Bell, Professor of Economics at Stirling University, thinks that when most people enter the polling booths tomorrow, the head will rule the heart.
There are a lot of very passionate people involved. There's no question about that. But I'm not convinced that that's what the average voter will be thinking about when they go into the booth.
It'll be cool, calm, economic calculation.
I think for many, many people, that'll be the case.
By Friday, we'll know whether Scotland is going to go it alone. It could be some time, however, before we know for sure whether that means the heart or the head has prevailed. In Glasgow, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Prepare, ladies and gentlemen, to mark the end of an era. Leonard Maltin's Movie Guide, a phone book thick staple of quick and easy film reviews for 35 years now, will soon no longer be with us. The 2015 edition will be its last in paper form. It will live on, though, online, as will its author's sensibilities. Leonard Maltin, thanks so much for coming to the studio.
My pleasure, Kai.
How do you watch movies today? There are so many options.
Well, my preferred way to watch a movie is the same way I've always preferred to watch it, on a theater screen. Now, as a member of the press, I get invited to, advanced showings, which are often in screening rooms here in Los Angeles, which are kind of modest-sized theaters, but they're still theaters. The screen is still larger than life, you might say, you're in a comfortable seat, there's good projection, and that's how I really enjoy most.
How long does it take you to know, once you start a film, whether it's a goodie or a baddie?
2 minutes.
Really?
I used to say that I stayed because I was hoping it would get better.
Yeah.
I no longer have that outlook. I'm staying because I have to stay. It's my job. It's my habit to stay. Mm. And I do stay. I never walk out of a screening. I stay to the bitter end, and sometimes it's bitter.
We're doing a series on the future of television, and I'm asking network executives and showrunners whether they think this is a good time to be in TV. And invariably the answer is, yeah, it's great because there are so many outlets for us. And they say that's why you see so many great television productions coming on and so many lousy movies, because all the good movie people are moving to television.
It's true. the movie studios, the major movie studios, are now making movies for the global market. For the most part, for the most part. Anything they invest real serious money in has got to be able to play in Beijing as easily as it plays in Peoria.
Right.
Something that doesn't have to earn back as much money, a modest comedy, a modest teen horror movie, you know, something like that. Those can live or die on their domestic success or failure. But anything more ambitious than that now has to play worldwide.
Are we doomed then to a theatrical future of Transformers Part 97 in which they take over Mars? Because Transformers, whatever it was on the moon, played really big in Beijing.
I don't see any change in the immediate future. Money talks. And look, it's always been a business.
Yeah.
It's always been a business, but the nature of the business has changed. Mm. For one thing, the studios used to be owned by themselves. They were owned, actually, in some cases, by theater companies, that is, chains of movie theaters, until the government broke up that monopoly in the late 1940s. But in the old days, Paramount Pictures played in Paramount Theaters, and Fox Pictures played in Fox Theaters. That was a cozy little setup. Then that changed. Television came along as competition to the movie studios in the 1950s. Now what's happened is most studios are part of even larger corporations. Mm-hmm. So now they're dealing with reporting to people who don't necessarily care about movies that much, know about movies that much, and they're also reporting to shareholders.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people to satisfy.
How much longer, not to try to put a limit on you, but how much longer are you going to do this? And as long as you can still sit in a chair and watch a film?
I love what I do. I first off, I love movies. And I love writing. I love expressing myself and saying things about subjects that matter to me, like movies.
Leonard Maltin is a film critic and a historian. Thanks very much for coming to the studio.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by UCLA Anderson School of Management, where students and executives learn to think in the next. Anderson.ucla.edu. By TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. Learn more at TiVo.com. And by Lookout, using big data and predictive analytics to protect people and enterprises from mobile threats worldwide. More information at lookout.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which Radisson Hotels winds up looking pretty good. As Stan Alcorn was telling us earlier, Radisson has cut its ties with the Minnesota Vikings. And this being capitalism, it took about that long for somebody to figure out how much of a benefit the hotel chain will get for having done that. A lot, it turns out. A digital research firm called Amobee Brand Insights says that in the past 18, 24 hours...
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.